You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
And welcome to Cigar Nerd Summer. It's hot outside, time to fire up the grill, and of course, fire up some stogies. You know, the beaches are open, and movies are back, so now we're going to be coming at you with brand new movies, and also brand new cigars. So, break out your tank tops, fire up the grill, lay out your beach blanket, and make us your summer destination. CigarNerdPodcast.com, also on the ESO Network at ESONetwork.com.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy that the modern man has never fought.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar companion. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we hope you all had a happy new year as we begin 2022. And I'm going to start things off with a film that's a little different. This is an intriguing little film that I ran across several years ago when it came out on DVD. Yeah, this is one I did not see as a kid growing up. It's called a regional film, and we have done regional films before. In fact, we did one last week when Clay and I talked about the film Zat. That was a regional film originally made just, you know, in and around the Miami area and pretty much stayed there for a little while before another distributor picked it up and released it nationwide. This film, very, very similar, except it was produced in the Dallas, Texas area. Name of the film this week is The Yesterday Machine. And it's a low-budget science fiction that was written and produced and directed by a fellow by the name of Russ Marker. And we're going to tell you a little bit more about Russ in just a minute. He produced a couple of films like this. I can warn ahead of time, we're going to spoil everything about The Yesterday Machine that there is to spoil, so be prepared. But you can find this film available online, streaming online. You can find it very easily. I believe it's also available on Tubi, if I'm not mistaken, you know, on some of these streaming services that handle older, not well-known films. So check that out. You can do a little Google search, and I think you'll be able to find it fairly easily. And it is available in some DVD packages. You may already own this film and not know it. So check it out. It came out several years ago, about 15 years ago, in a DVD package with some other very low-budget sci-fi and monster movie type things. I didn't see this film until after it came out on DVD. So the reason I'm including it in a Monster Attack review is that when I saw it, it was like, wow, this is so much like some of those low-budget films I saw as a kid. And I'm surprised it didn't make it onto the monster movie matinee circuit. But that was the nature of regional films. They were never intended to be produced outside of their immediate surroundings. Of course, now with DVDs and all of the nostalgia craze that's going on with finding these old films and restoring them and looking at them, it makes it a little easier for those to go nationwide now. But, you know, things were different back then. This film came out in 1965, although you'll find some people say 1963, but and I looked very heavily into this. I watched this film a couple of times and looked specifically at the automobiles because I'd read on one site that some of the car enthusiasts said, well, wait a minute, there's some cars in there that are 1965, and they were right. There were three cars that are very clearly from 1965, so I'm going to go with 1965. It's when it was released in the Dallas area, and it actually was had a limited release in some movie theaters down there. So it did actually make it into a couple of big theaters in the Dallas area, and then it pretty much was relegated to being a drive-in feature for about almost 10 years, and then sort of lay in limbo until the DVD people picked it up and released it. I think it was 2003 when it first came out on a DVD. So It's got quite a history and some things about it that I can't confirm, but I'm going to speculate about in just a minute here, based on just some of the things I know about film and video work and things of that nature. It's a movie about time travel, hence the name The Yesterday Machine, and specifically about Nazis and time travel. Yeah, all right. See, and that's one thing that I sort of gravitated to when I first saw it, because I've always been intrigued with some of these Nazis goes back in time or into the future or whatever type pictures that have come around. And, of course, now you can find several television shows that deal with the Nazi super weapons that were in development during World War II, and one in particular that involved time travel called The Bell, which you can find TV shows talking about that quite a bit. The Nazis were fascinated with the idea of time travel and bending the space-time continuum. So let's dive into this movie, The Yesterday Machine, 1965. Let's talk a little bit about Russ Marker. Marker is the guy that came up with this. And Russ was a veteran during World War II. He kept hearing these stories when he was serving in Europe, you know, about the Nazis and these super weapons, and they were interested in time travel and stuff. So when he got back to the States and you know, after he got into the film industry, he got thinking, this would make a pretty good story. You know, the whole idea of maybe Nazis, you know, going back in time and changing the present or whatever. You know, we how many stories of that have we seen? I can think of one in particular, a very famous episode of Twilight Zone, where a fellow tries to go back in time and assassinate Adolf Hitler and try to prevent the Holocaust and all of the horrors that came out of World War II, but is unsuccessful. And there have been other films that and TV shows that have dealt with that subject. So it's an interesting subject, and I'm going to give Russ, you know, kudos for, it's a nice idea. You know, it's a good concept. Now, where he may fall down a little bit is in the execution of it. So, and that does fall in his lap because he did write the screenplay for this film. In fact, you know, Russ is not a well-known director or writer other than The Yesterday Machine. He directed one other film called The Demon from Devil's Lake. I've not seen that one. It's another regional film that he directed down there. And then another one that he did that he wrote for, which I have seen, it's pretty abysmal, folks, called Night Fright. It's one of those real low-budget John Agar films that John made. It's rough. But maybe we'll do a Ragarama on that one. I don't think this film deserves a Ragarama. The Yesterday Machine, there's some things that just intrigue me about this. But, you know, it's a rough film. It's got its problems. And we will be honest with you and tell you about some of those. But Russ Marker, probably known more as an actor for what he did. I mean, he appeared in 9 films, including one called Beyond the Time Barrier, which we have not done a show on yet. It's a 1960 sci-fi, which is, you know, it's a low-budget sci-fi too, but this one was not bad. This one made the rounds in the Monster Movie Matinee circuit. I saw it several times on Monster Movie Matinee growing up. He was a bank guard in Bonnie and Clyde, so, you know, he did extra work and that sort of thing. And he was also, you know, in addition to writing the screenplay for Night Fright in 1967, also appeared as one of the characters in that. So, you know, he appeared a couple of times on Walker, Texas Ranger. And his last appearance was in a video the year after he died, so it was shot just before he died. A video that's called Bikini Detectives. I'll leave that to your imagination. That's really not Monster Attack fair. So, you know, Russ was just sort of in and out of the film industry, you know, and doing what he loved. And this was a film that he handled from start to finish. And, you know, again, like my feelings with Ed Wood and stuff, you know, more power to him. He got it in a theater. He got it distributed and got it made. And that's a lot more than a lot of aspiring filmmakers can claim in their lifetime. So kudos to that. The direction in this film and stuff it's very loosely directed. I should say it's directed almost like a television show and almost like a live television show. And I'm going to tell you a theory I have about this movie. So before we get into that, let's talk about the people that you're going to see in this film. One in particular is a favorite of mine, Tim Holt, who was a cowboy star. His father was also a very popular cowboy actor as well. He followed in his father's footsteps. Now, we talked about Tim, I guess the last time we talked about him was in a movie that he actually came out of retirement to do, starring in The Monster That Challenged the World, which there's some folks that claim that's a bad movie. It's one of my favorite monster movies. I've always enjoyed that film. We may revisit it again here on Monster Attack, because I think I did it, probably about three or four seasons ago. But I've just always gotten a kick out of that movie. And Tim Holt was a really good, competent actor. At one time in the 40s, he was considered one of the top 10 leading moneymakers as a cowboy actor. So, I mean, he had quite a career with RKO Pictures that did all those Westerns. And, appeared in The Treasure of Sierra Madre and a couple of others, The Great Ambersons. He was in some big films and was well regarded as an actor. And he got out of the business for a little while and retired. Well, act for an appearance he made on Chevron Theater, the TV series. There were a lot of these TV series that did live plays and stuff on television. And he just decided to hang it up, but then came back out of retirement. This is when he came out in 1957 for Monster That Challenged the World. Then again, went back into retirement until he came out and did The Yesterday Machine. And I assume, since he was living in Texas, in the Texas area, and Russ Marker was probably familiar with him, he was approached, and again, I can't confirm this, but it was probably approached by Russ Marker and said, hey, I really want to get a name, in this movie. And Tim Holt is the name in the movie. He's showing his age a little bit in this, but he still puts in a very competent performance for this. And I won't say carries the movie, but is more than capable of doing that. So a familiar face and always a very, very likable character actor. So that drew me into the film as well, in addition to the subject matter of, their tagline when this came out on DVD was basically Nazi scientist tries to get Hitler back into the future or whatever. So it was enough to get my attention to make me want to watch this movie. Another familiar face that you're going to see in here is Bill Thurman. And you might remember we talked about Bill. Bill is a very, very popular character actor, but he did a lot of low-budget films. And one in particular that that Mark and I talked about, It's Alive, the Larry Buchanan It's Alive. Not the Larry Cohen one, but the Larry Buchanan one. Remember, the really, really bad, considered one of the worst films ever made. He did a lot of films with Larry Buchanan. Larry used him as pretty much his name guy, Curse of the Swamp Creature. Well, they had John Agar in that too, as well as Zontar Thing from Venus. And some of those, we talked about Larry Buchanan given some scripts that he wanted to remake some old Corman pictures for television. And It's Alive and Zontar was one of the, and we will probably talk about Zontar on this show at one time, but Bill was just a very, very popular actor up until the mid-90s. He died in the 90s. He was 75 years old when he passed away. We don't know what he died of, but he had quite a career. I mean, he stayed working quite a lot. I mean, he even appeared in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He's one of the, if you look closely, you'll see him as one of the air traffic controllers, he and Morgan Freeman. In there. So, I mean, he just showed up in a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot of TV and films. So you got your two ringers in this low-budget film with Tim Holt and Bill Thurman. In this, Bill Thurman plays a police detective, as Tim Holt does, too. Holt plays the main police detective investigating the disappearance of a young lady in the beginning of this film. And Bill is one of his assistants, one of his detective assistants. And then the other guy I'm going to talk about, and you might not recognize him that much, but the only other guy on this cast who had any kind of career at all is Jack Herman, who plays our Nazi scientist. Jack Herman had quite a career in New York on stage before he moved to the Dallas area. And then he got very active in the theater in Dallas. And so he appeared in a lot of theater shows now and there. And was a pick for this film and appeared in a couple of other films. He was also in Beyond the Time Barrier. Again, we're going to have to talk about that film one of these days. It's that's sort of an interesting little film. He was in The Seventh Commandment and The Naked Witch, which is sort of an exploitation film. Those are his big credits. That's that and the Yesterday Machine. He's got four big credits. So that is Jack's career. And so you've heard the big three that are in this movie. James Britton, who plays a reporter by the name of Jim Crandall, this is his only credit. And again, he was a Dallas, Texas actor who made it in here, as well as Ann Pellegrino, who plays a lounge singer whose sister disappears. She is Sandy DeMar, and then her sister is Margie DeMar, played by Linda Jenkins. Linda actually appeared in another film that I'd never heard of, probably one that was shot also in the Dallas, Texas area. Again, virtually everybody you see in this movie will have, unless you're from Dallas, Texas in the 60s, you're not going to recognize them. They're all people that were probably involved in community theaters down there, or regional theaters, or people that, even these guys didn't even appear in many other regional films at all. So this is like a one and done for most of this cast, which is very similar to what we talked about last week with Zat. Same thing, except they were actors from the Miami, Florida area. So now let's get into this. One thing I noticed when I first saw this, and so I'm going to go off tangent just a little bit here to tell you that early on in my adult life, before I got into radio, I actually worked in television first. I know I did it sort of in reverse. I worked for a big TV station, a big cable station in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's right after I got out of the university. And this was in the days when, VCRs were just starting to come around. I mean, they were still, I would say, prohibitively expensive to have in your household. The little half-inch ones really hadn't come around yet. You could get the big ones, and we worked with 3/4-inch videotape cassettes. Before that, TV stations had worked with 1-inch videotape, and they'd be on big spools. And that's how all these live TV shows from the 50s and stuff that were recording video. When video became available, I mean, some of the early episodes of like I Love Lucy and some of the others, there still was no video available yet. And they would do what was called a kinescope, where they would take a TV camera and shoot the show. And then they would be recording the show on film with a camera pointing at a TV screen. That's why they sort of look sort of fuzzy and sort of weird. So video, was very noticeable, very noticeably different from film. And even nowadays, with the big advances, there are some people who claim that they can tell the difference between video and film. I can't anymore. Once high def came in, and now we're up to 8K and 16K, virtually every movie that you see from here on out is shot on video because the definition is so clear and so perfect. It rivals film, and it's a lot cheaper to shoot on video than on film. But back in the 60s, if you were going to shoot something on video, it was very apparent it was video. Few minutes into this movie, The Yesterday Machine, I could tell this isn't film. Even though when I looked up, in all my film books and stuff, they said, this was, 35mm. I was thinking, no, that's not 35mm. It just does not look like film. It doesn't have the clarity that film would have. Even if you were, even if you were shooting it on 16mm, it would look clearer than what this is looking like. This looks like a live TV show in a TV studio. Now, one thing that I did find out was that the interior scenes were shot in a recording studio in Dallas, Texas, and it was a recording studio that was owned by the music director, the man who did all the music for the movie. And I got thinking, I bet you they used that studio like you would a TV studio, because basically TV studios were just a big wide open expanse, like a big warehouse type thing. All the ones I worked in were basically that, were old like warehouses that they converted into studios, and then you would soundproof them and you could shoot in there. And I believe that this film was shot using television cameras. That's what it looks like to me. And then when it was distributed to the theaters, you know, on the limited release that they put it on film then. Then it was put on 35 millimeter because back in the 60s, movie theaters couldn't show video. Nowadays, they all show video because it's all digital. It's all high definition. And basically, the movie theaters that you go to now, when they get a big release, it's not delivered to the movie theater, you know, like they used to be, where they put the movie cans out there by the door for the projectionist to get, because they had to put them all together and all that stuff. No, they come in on a satellite, and the satellite feeds into a machine that's in the movie theater, and then that's fed into like basically a mini computer and a big projector that projects it out onto the screen. And that's virtually how all of the modern movie theaters work now. There are still theaters that show 35 using the old 35 prints, but for the most part, it's all on digital. Well, anyway, I'm going round and round and round on this because I am convinced, folks, that Marker used the studio and made his sets. His sets look like TV sets. And this is one of the things that hurts the film a little bit, because they're clearly either plywood or cardboard or whatever. You know, it's like you would have seen on a monster movie matinee. I know when I appeared, you know, with my Cub Scout pack on the Baron DeMone show back in the 60s in Syracuse, New York, their sets were all made out of cardboard, but they shot them in such a way that it looked like, you know, like a stone in a castle and all that stuff. And well, we all know it was fake when we watched those things. But that's how TV stations did it. These sets look like that. They look like they're either very thin plywood or cardboard. And it hurts the film a little bit. Now, the exteriors, I think they still continued using a television camera to shoot them because they have that look about them. The other giveaway is the sound, because video from the 60s had a particular, the sound wasn't as clean as it was in film. They recorded sound differently. If you recorded directly to videotape, it didn't sound as good. So the interior scenes, with a couple of exceptions, had sound that was a little tinny, a little echoey. You know, it's hard to explain, but you can tell when the producers had to go back and redub a lot of the dialogue. There's a couple of scenes where it really stands out, because also the dialogue's all clean and balanced and has been compressed, you know, and sounds good, where they did what they call ADR, additional dialogue recording, where the actors would come in, they would put them in front of the screen, and they would redo their lines watching themselves on screen so they could match up with the lips. Very clearly done. You know, there was a couple of movies, like I think Zat, I think if we're not mistaken, I think it all of the dialogue was redubbed. That's why you had so much narration in that film. They didn't go to that extreme here, but it's very noticeable between scenes that don't match up sound-wise. Some sounds a little cleaner than others. So I suspect they shot the majority of this film, probably about 90% of this film, in this studio in Dallas, Texas, and they shot it using television cameras, you know, the big moving television cameras that you would use in a TV studio. I can't prove that, and I can't find anybody to confirm that, but that's what it looks like to me. And then it was later transferred onto a 35 millimeter film, and watch it and see what you think. You can write me on the fan site or whatever and let me know what you think, because I'm convinced that this film was shot on video. And so that cheapens it a little bit as well. But anyway, we open up. We've got two cheerleaders that are headed. They're college cheerleaders, a guy and a girl, the boyfriend and girlfriend. They're heading to a ball game. They had permission where they didn't have to ride on the bus with the band and everybody else, so they could come in their own car. It's not explained why they wanted to do that, but they end up taking a shortcut to get to the ball game, and they're out in the middle of nowhere, and the car breaks down. And it's a fuel pump, so it's not the kind of thing you can fix. There's no gas station anywhere near. But they did see a house about 2 miles back. So the boyfriend says, hey, we could cut through these woods and save even more time. Now, folks, you know as well as I do that anytime a person suggests shortcuts, don't listen. Just don't listen. You know, my dad, God love him, used to love telling me about shortcuts, you know, would give me directions. You know, this is in the days before GPS. Give me directions and shortcuts to certain places, and they never panned out. They were always three times longer than if I'd just gone the easy way. So it works that way in movies, too. If the guy says, let's take a shortcut, you say no. No, no shortcuts, because it gets them into trouble. They get they end up running into a couple of characters. We don't know who they are because we only see it from the character's point of view. So, in other words, we see the kids. And we hear these guys talking. It sounds like they've got a very pronounced Southern accent. We don't know who they are, but the two kids take off. Something's not right. They say, you know, they make a comment about what are you doing in costume, or, and you know, what are you doing in the middle of, you know, the middle of nowhere here, dressed like that, or whatever. And then we hear gunfire. The girl gets away initially, but the guy gets shot, and he collapses back on the road, right where his car's broken down, where he is found by some people that are coming up the road, and they take him to a nearby hospital. Now, he survives, but the girl remains missing. And that sets into motion the chain of events that we're going to see in this film. That's when we meet Tim Holt's character, Lieutenant Partain, who is the lead detective on this. Now, this reporter, who is supposed to be going on vacation... So, you know, they just throw a little rub in there. This Jim Crandall, played by James Britton, he's supposed to be going on vacation and makes no bones about the fact that, hey, I go on vacation tomorrow, but they want him to, his editor wants him to go check out this kid who was in the hospital who's been shot. And so he goes, okay, yeah, all right, I'll do that. When he gets to the hospital, the kid can't tell him much, but the doctor there says, look, I'm going to show you something pretty odd. He says, you know, luckily where he was shot didn't hit any major organs, so he's going to be okay. And he's worried about his girlfriend, you know, because he doesn't know what happened to her, and she hasn't come home. But he said, I pulled this out of him. And he holds up a mini ball. Any of you that know anything about Civil War history, you know, I think I've got a couple here that I collected from North Carolina that were given to me as gifts. You know, holds up, but, you know, the minute I saw it, I said, yeah, that's a mini ball. And he said, and he tells me, he says, that's a Civil War mini ball. He says, you know, I don't know what anybody was doing shooting one of those out in the middle of the woods, but so that adds a little bit of mystery to it. So, you know, you know what's going to happen. Jim Crandall goes, screw the vacation. We'll just put it off for a while, and we've got to investigate this. We've got to find out what's going on. But the first thing he does is this gal, Margie, the little cheerleader, Margie, her sister is a well-known lounge singer named Sandy DeMar, played by Ann Pellegrino. Now, I'm not sure if Ann actually sings the music. We see her performing, you know, so they throw in a performance song, a little filler here, that was written by our music director. You know, it was sort of a typical lounge type song or whatever. So, yeah, it's okay, you know, didn't do anything for me. But anyway, you know, sort of like the act that you saw in Frankenstein versus Dracula, you know, that sort of thing. But Crandall talks to Sandy and he says, you know, I'm looking into your sister's disappearance because she has reported her missing, and she wants to follow Crandall on his, you know, she says, I want you to take me out to where she disappeared, and so they go out there. To make a long story short, while they're tromping around in the woods looking for her sister, they end up in a clearing where they disappear. We see them just disappear. One of the reasons I thought this was shot on video was the effect of them disappearing looks exactly like what would happen if you had a television switcher and did a dual image fade. You know, I don't want to get too technical here, but it doesn't look like the way you would make someone disappear on film. But it looks exactly like the way you'd make them disappear on television. So I think it convinces me even more they shot this on video. So we don't know what happened to them, but they wake up in this place. We don't know where they are. We find out they're underground. They're in some kind of bunker. And this is the laboratory for Professor Hauser. Yeah. Our, you know, again, he's our German scientist. And he explains that he's got her sister, and he locks Margie up in a cell and lock Sandy in with her, and they take Crandall and they lock him in a cell too. And we see all this Nazi stuff floating around. You know, there's a Nazi flag on the wall. There are these two guys, these two stooges, you know, his muscle. They're wearing like, looks like brown shirt costumes or whatever. Unfortunately, the costuming in this looks like it, you know, came out of a costume shop. So, you know, I think probably they got a lot of help from some of the theater folks on this one. Or maybe there's a big costume shop in Dallas, but the costumes are questionable. There's also an Egyptian girl. And when I say an Egyptian girl, like one from ancient Egypt, like the time of Cleopatra, who was roaming around there as well, as he explains that he is dealing with time and he's experimenting with time. And he explains that, he's been doing that since World War II. One of the drawbacks to this film, and I'm going to warn you about it right now, is when Hauser explains his theory of time travel and how it works. It's about 15 minutes of the film. This film is like an hour and 20 minutes long. So 15 minutes of it is Hauser explaining how this all works. And unfortunately, this is where I got to get on Russ a little bit, because Russ wrote the screenplay. Yes, his science is a little questionable. I give him a little bit of a pass on the fact that this is 1963 and we didn't really know a whole lot. But at least if he stuck with Einstein's theory, which he tries to incorporate Einstein's theory of relativity into this by saying that time travel basically involves moving faster than the speed of light, which is supposed to be the fastest you could ever. Okay, we've all heard that in every science fiction film known to man. So this is familiar territory. But then he talks about how he's able to speed it up or whatever. And he ends up contradicting himself a couple of times while he's going rambling on and on and on about how this all works. And he's drawing on a blackboard and all this stuff. And folks, I got to be honest with you. The first time I watched this movie, I'm going to be totally honest and upfront with you on this, I fell asleep during this section. Yeah, watching it on DVD, and I just nodded off as he was going on and on and on. This for just like 15 minutes, and then I came back to and you know, missed a whole bunch of the movie. I had to go back and rewatch it. So I'm warning you, it's boring. It's dull. This section, it's a shame that they couldn't have done it a little differently, or at least made it a little more interesting. But unfortunately, Jack Herman just sort of has not a very exciting delivery. Warning, that is the slowest part of the movie. And it doesn't go well. Well, all this time we've got Tim Holt's character, Lieutenant Partain, and he and Bill Thurman with his police lieutenant, you know, they're exploring all of this around here, trying to figure out what all is going on. They find this old house that's abandoned. They don't know, you know, why, you know, and there's a graveyard next to it and all of that, but that nothing, you know, that nothing is adding up. But finally, Crandall finds a way to get free, with the help from his little Egyptian gal that we have been told has been brought to, you know, that is part of the time travel experiment. See, these two Nazi stooges he went and got. And then he got this gal from Egypt, I guess, you know, just as part of the experiment, and kept him there. But unfortunately, where he contradicts himself again is where he's dealing with Margie. He wants to send her into the future. This is the plan, to send Margie into the future. But he says, I'm not sure if it'll work or not. I've never sent anyone into the future, so I'm not sure. And of course, the first time I saw this, I thought, wait a minute. You went back to Nazi Germany and got these two Nazi guys, so you had to send them into the future from where you were at to send back to your present. I know I'm being very technical here. And the same thing with the Egyptian guys. So in a sense, you did send people into the future, or otherwise you would have not been able to get back to where you started. But that got sort of overlooked in the script writing. Come on, Russ, you blew that one, okay? You should have caught that one, because just about everybody that watched this with me caught it as well. And you will catch it too. So there are problems with the script. But still, you know, I want to see how this is going to end. So it's one of those films, with the exception of that 15 minutes, that's very, very dull. You know, the film is, yeah, you know, what the heck? You can have a lot of fun with it, you know. Again, I'm not going to rag on it too hard, But it's just an intriguing little film. I'm just really intrigued to see where these guys are going to go with this. Well, Crandall gets loose. He's able to get Sandy loose, and they're going after Margie. And they have a big confrontation with Hauser. And after Crandall is able to knock out one of the Stooges and grab his weapon, it's a Luger, of course, he's able to shoot the professor and get Margie. Now, Margie has already been sent to wherever she's going to be sent to. She disappears into the future. And Crandall, you know, is holding the gun on Hauser and says, "You bring her back. You bring her back right now." And he's able to bring her back. Apparently, she's unharmed. She's okay. So we don't know where she went to in the future, but she went to somewhere in the future and then came back totally unharmed. She was tied down in this chair. And I always wondered about that. You know, he had her tied down to this chair and then shot her into the future. Now, I wonder, in the future, would she be still tied down? I don't know. These are questions you have to ask in films of this nature. Yes, listen to the sarcasm in my voice. Anyway, so Margie is back. So you've got Margie and Sandy together. Of course, Sandy has fallen for Jim Crandall. You can see this coming a mile away. Although I think she's got a little age on him. It looks like, you know, it's a sort of a mismatch in age. But maybe Jim Crandall looks younger than he really is. But anyway, you sort of knew that was coming. And of course, Margie will be you know, get back with her boyfriend. But anyway, we find out that there is a way to get out of this bunker, and it's through a fake grave by this house that Partain and the cops are investigating, and they're talking, and all of a sudden here comes Crandall and the two DeMar gals coming out through this grave. It looks sort of like a basement door covered with leaves and stuff, but it's made to look like a grave. And they crawl out and they say, "Yeah, there's a guy down there. He's a Nazi. You know, he has a time machine. That's what all this weird stuff is that's going on and all that. That's where those weird rebel soldiers, I guess, came from that the boyfriend claims, you know, shot him and all that stuff." Yeah, again, that's another instance where Hauser brought someone into the future because he took them out of Civil War era and brought them into the 1960s. So just, I don't want to be picky on this, but I just have to point that out. Anyway, so Partain and the cops go down into the bunker, and Hauser is still alive. And the machine is still working. Now, I should have mentioned that Crandall fired a couple of shots into the gizmo, and all these sparks and flames and stuff came out of it. So he figured, oh, he destroyed the machine. But no, he did not destroy the machine. Because here goes Hauser trying to send himself somewhere, even though he's been shot and he's dying. He disappears just as the cops get there. And, of course, they make sure the machine is destroyed to eliminate the Nazi threat. Of course, I'm wondering, did they eliminate the Nazi threat? Because, you know, what happened to Hauser? Did he survive wherever he was? He sent himself with a chance of making a new machine. Anyway. I'm thinking sequel here, but that never did happen, which is probably just as well. And everything, you know, the machine is destroyed and the threat is eliminated and everybody lives happily ever after as the end sign comes up. Now, I noticed in the end credits, and I don't want to harp on this too bad, but, you know, again, because I was sort of intrigued with the fact that this looked like a video production. Like one of those old TV, like one of those old live TV productions that we see kinescopes of nowadays, you know, like the U.S. Steel Hour and some of the other ones that did live television plays. It looks just like that. At the end, even though this film was distributed by Carter Films, or that's who they give credit to, there's another company that slips into the credits right at the very end that says so-and-so video productions. That, to me, is sort of the giveaway that maybe, yeah, they did shoot this on video and transfer it on film. You know, I'll give them kudos for the fact that, you know, I think that Russ Marker had a good idea. Everybody tries to make it work. It would have been better if Marker could have found someone with a little more knowledge of physics to help him with the script. It doesn't help that the sets are really cheap looking and that it looks like, you know, like a small TV studio. But other than that, I've had fun with this film, with the exception of that one 15-minute period where Hauser is explaining his theory. That just, oh, that is very, very dull. But, you know, it's one of those films that in sections, it's a bad movie, yes. It's made poorly. but it's still sort of fun to play with. Some folks that I know actually found this on VHS. I never did find it on VHS, but I can imagine it probably was released. If it was released on DVD, then certainly there's probably old VHS copies floating around somewhere. I'm sure they're out of print by now. But it's like one of those movies that you would, you know, go into the video rental store and find in the mid 80s. Trying to think, I think I got my first VCR somewhere around 85 or 86. And, you know, like in those video stores before the Blockbusters and the Hollywood videos popped up and bought them all, you know, the little mom and pop shops that popped up and you'd go in, you know, on a Friday night and get your three movies for the weekend or whatever. And then you had to have them back by Monday. So it's worth a look, folks, just because it's so intriguing at what they did. I don't know what the budget was on this movie, but I do understand that from what I read, Russ Marker was able to go to a bunch of millionaires in the Dallas, Texas area. There are a lot of millionaires that live in Dallas because of the oil business. And they were all veterans of World War II and people that he had known from being in the Army. And these are the folks that liked the idea of the story of some mad scientist trying to go back and grab Hitler and bring him back to our present to start a new Fourth Reich. So they were the ones that put up the money for the film. So there was a little money that went into this. How much, I don't know. But I couldn't find anything definitive on that. Again, look for it. I think I'm pretty sure you can see it on Tubi. In fact, I'm almost positive that's where I first saw this film not too long ago. Just when I was looking around before I dug all my DVDs back back out from moving. You know how that is. But anyway, The Yesterday Machine, 1965. It's an hour and 25 minutes long. It's fun to watch Tim Holt in action again. He comes out of retirement to do this, probably as a favor for Russ Marker. And check it out. Have some fun with it. Get a bunch of people over big thing of popcorn. Have some fun talking to the screen and stuff. You can pull a Mystery Science Theater 3000 party or something like that. And just have some fun with The Yesterday Machine. I'm still, Russ, you got it done, and you got it in theaters, and it's running now on DVD, and it has found a following. So, yeah, more power to you. God love you. he's not around anymore to know how, what this film is doing, but it did do something. So, The Yesterday Machine. Enough on that. Hey, folks, we are almost to our sixth anniversary show, and Mark and Clay will be with us for that one. And we are looking forward to that. We got one more show to go before that show, though. So we hope you'll join us again next Monday for an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Have a great week, folks, and we will see you then.
We're the Con Guys, coming to you straight from the nerdy heart of Hollywood, California. We are your home for news, opinions, and interviews from the world of Comic-Cons and fandoms, your ultimate insiders for all things con.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.